Welcome to My on Mondays, an explorative approach to the possessive my through narratives, art, and sound. Each Monday brings a new creation and unique perspective. My on Mondays is brought to you by Ming Studios, a contemporary art space and international artist residency program dedicated to the exhibition, experience, and exploration of arts and culture. Along with exhibiting artists from around the world, Ming also serves the community by hosting innovative programs including performances, workshops, screenings, readings, artist talks, and other cultural activities. For more information, or if you'd like to participate in My on Mondays, you can visit our website at mingstudios.org. Hello, and welcome to the 132nd episode of My on Mondays. For today's episode, three angsty poets, Rebecca Evans, Tomas Baiza, and Christian Wynn, gathered together to chat initially about poetry, but the conversation turned, and they found themselves invigorated, inspired, but mostly miffed at the world, the gods, the past, the future. Here's the first of their series of angsty thoughts, My Angst on Your Perception, where they chat about audience and readers' assumptions pressed on the narrator, the speaker, or the poet. Rebecca Evans writes the difficult, the heartful, the guidebooks for survivors. Her work has appeared in Narratively, The Rumpus, Brevity, and more. She's earned two MFAs, one in creative nonfiction, the other in poetry from the University of Nevada, Reno at Lake Tahoe. She's authored a full-length poetry collection, Tangled by Blood, published by Moontide Press in 2023, and has a second poetry book, Safe Handling, forthcoming in 2024. She shares space with four Newfoundlands and her sons in a tiny Idaho town. Tomas Baiza is originally from San Jose, California, and now finds himself in Boise, Idaho. He's the author of the novel Delivery, A Pocho's Accidental Guide to College, Love, and Pizza Delivery, published by Running Wild Press in 2023, and the mixed genre collection A Purpose to Our Savagery from Rise Press. Delivery was selected as the 2024 Treasure Valley Reads featured novel, and Tomas's writing has been nominated for the Pushcart Prize, the Best of the Net, and Best American Short Stories anthologies. Tomas has fenced in Italy, been rescued by helicopter from the Sierra Nevada, fended off wild dogs while hitchhiking in rural Morelos, Mexico, and once delivered a dozen pizzas to a Klingon-themed orgy at a sci-fi convention. When he's not writing, Tomas is running trails or obsessing over bonsai trees. Christian Wynn is a fiction writer, poet, nonfiction writer, teacher of creative writing, and producer of literary and storytelling events based in Boise, Idaho. He's the author of two story collections, Naked Me and What's Wrong With You Is What's Wrong With Me, and the forthcoming novels Crocodile and My History with Careless People and Other Stories. His work has appeared in McSweeney's, Plowshares, the Chicago Tribune's Printer's Row Journal, Glimmer Train, Joyland, Expat Press, Tri-Quarterly, Gulf Coast, and many other fine magazines and journals. And from 2016 to 2019, he was the Idaho Writer in Residence, the state's highest literary honor.
Cadence. Everyone who damaged my body gathers, blathers about me as though I've vanished.
We're gonna move her body round, move her body, body.
I'm fragmented, segmented, vacant in their presence.
We're gonna break her body down, break her body, body.
I charge from binge to binge. They always break my body down, break my body, body. I trudge with the finest, the fallen, while those backdrop voices dress into cadence, like precise soldiers marching in formation. I don't know, but I've been told.
Becky's broken, cold and old.
I don't know, but it's been said.
Becky's fractured, close to dead.
Sound off.
One, two.
Sound off.
Three, four.
Bring her on down now.
One, two, three, four. One, two, three, four.
We just read Rebecca Evans' poem, Cadence.
Yes, thank you. And by we mean three angsty poets, which includes myself, Rebecca Evans, Christian Wynn, and Tomas Baeza. And we've gathered to talk about writing angst and what audiences often perceive from our writings. With this piece, Cadence, when read aloud, there's a little discomfort both for the reader and the audience, and the impression is often, wow, Rebecca, you've had some bad experiences with men, and so you just must really hate them all. But let me begin by saying I don't hate men. I just dislike mean people who betray trust, and that happens regardless of gender. I mean, I love men, I'm raising sons into men, and I wrote this piece to make a different point. So I really want to know, Christian and Tomas, how did you feel reading the piece, singing the piece, and what do you think my point might be?
I will admit that I had to dissociate a little bit. Mm-hmm. Knowing what the poem is about, I don't want to perform. I want to listen and think about or feel about what it does to me. It prompts me to think about a lot of things, my role in how we treat women, how women might feel. And so it's actually really hard. I wasn't sure that I was going to be able to do it. So to do it, I actually had to turn off those parts of me and simply perform, and then realize that I was doing it and say to myself, okay, this feels sort of like I'm being a little bit monstrous in turning that part of me off.
Yeah, I concur to a degree. I think I kind of could get out of my own mind a bit about it and know that's the art of it. Certainly not I'm not a singer, we'll say. Said, I've never been in the military.
Of us are singers.
You sounded pretty good, Rebecca, I have to say. Tomas, you sounded better than me, for sure. But, I've never called Cadence before, so just that part of it made me a little bit nervous. I'm like, okay. Or just sort of the notion of it's kind of wild, I think, in the first place, but I think it's a good blend with the themes in your poetry, and it obviously as a military person. Did you ever sing Cadence in the military?
Oh, my gosh, yeah. And that... It's interesting because there's a lot of circulation on what Cadence is, and when you first join the military, you're taught, you know, singing Jody or calling Jody or singing Cadence and that type of thing, and it feels like you're bonding. There's this energy with you and all these other people who have no idea what you're doing, right? You're just trying to stay in step and not do extra push-ups, really. And that's like the main point, but really there's a desensitization that happens with the songs and cadence or the type of cadence. A lot of them are circulating around violence and difficult stories. And so with that being said, you're in the military. You might be required to commit and participate in acts of violence for a greater good is the belief system. And so to disassociate, like what you two had to do, and to desensitize. And if we read this, you know, for 6 weeks straight, you know, hours on end, over and over, eventually it just would have no meaning to you. You wouldn't have to dissociate anymore.
Like it's like saying a word over and over and over.
Absolutely.
It loses its meaning in your own mind.
Right. Brainwashing. So that's what I mean.
It's
also,
brainwashing. Exactly. Yeah.
And also, quick question again to follow up. Just like for yourself in constructing this poem, this is obviously maybe an echo in your own experience, what you're writing about, you know, the cadence form that blends into sort of body, just your body being kind of taken for granted and being abused and such. So how was that, like that experience of adding cadence to it after your own experience in like the quote unquote real world as a military person?
Yeah, for me, the cadence, I mean, you know, as a writer, you know, you're trying to find a form that makes sense for how you want your work to be delivered. And for me, cadence made sense. But this was not about the cadence outside of me or in the military or by things done to me. This is the cadence in my head. This is the beat up, the negative self-talk, the, you know, self-mutilation that happens when we're constantly putting ourselves down, and there's social roles that, you know, do that. So this isn't a real cadence,
no,
right?
No, I didn't
this
imagine is, yeah. so. Yeah, I hope not.
They're not
especially when they're, you know, using
Becky's
your name.
Becky's old and cold and dead. And
that's,
no.
what I meant, that's what I meant, like kind of I mean, transferring that to your own,
yeah.
Yeah, your own spirit. You came up with this, and like, and you were kind of maybe calling cadence in your own mind without really having words for it, then you put it down.
Right, right. Well, I think we do that. I mean, how many times do you say, oh, I'm not worthy of that, or that's not good enough, or, you know, I don't measure up. And so I feel like that's close to the sounds in the conversation. It's kind of the anti-muse, right? It's the alter part of you that is dark and says horrible things to you. And I think everybody deals with those types of demons, but putting it into cadence was a delivery system, right? And it made it a little more oblique, so a little more approachable, you know, like anything. Like when you write a poem, it's easier to talk about something difficult. You can use beautiful language. I think that's true of songs or cadence or other forms. Yeah.
Cool. Well, I enjoyed calling cadence in a certain way, but also it is, like Tomas said, this pretty, it's tough. It's rough stuff to think about. Broken, cold, and old, fractured, close to dead, you know, not great.
Yeah, and I think the point of like why we're in conversation is about what people perceive of this poem when it's read. And that is like, I'm full of anger towards people outside of me. And there's this angst outside of me, which there sometimes is, but really it's more the angst within me, my own battle with me. And so that's interesting, the perception that's out there, which is why, you know, we're talking about poetry, angsty pieces, and how they can be misperceived. And Tomas, you're up next. So you brought something to read that can be misperceived and maybe be a little bit angsty.
Thank you. This is called Proud and Not a Little Sad. You were raised by wolves to live with dogs, taught to look down, bow your head, to never bare your teeth, lest you be labeled off-putting, combative, intimidating. To pass, because isn't that always the point? You must accept the collar, submit to the ritual grooming, meekly absorb those things called constructive criticisms, and never, ever tell the truth, lest you be labeled uppity, contrary, menacing. To survive in a kennel where instincts are dulled, howls are muted, and tails must always be wagged in performative appreciation for the slop heaped on your tray, instead of the sweeter meat you would have hunted if you were still a wolf. You dare to ask, may I not still be one of you? Don't be silly, they say. We were wolves so that you wouldn't have to be. We slaughtered our own chickens, grew our own corn, and built our own homes by hand. We ate chicharrones for fuck's sake. But then we gave you a leg up, moved to the suburbs, let them teach you English, send you to Catholic school to memorize the declensions and tame your wild accent. We have given you what the dog said was too good for us. You will make us proud in your transformation. Proud and not a little sad for the wolf you might have been.
Oh my gosh. Tomas, first of all, thank you for sharing that piece. I love, what I love so much about your work is your weave of culture and your stance with culture and not turning away from it, just hitting it face on. And I could see in a lot of your work, I've actually heard comments in the audience, from the audience of, you know, what they think your work might be about. And for this piece, I mean, I love that it's holding true to your stance, believing and belonging and maintaining culture despite all the social pressures to not.
Right. Yeah, and I just enjoy the second person voice and the narrative of it all. You know, you begin with birth, you know, or just at least being raised by you know, the metaphorical wolves, to live with dogs. And I am curious even about that first line that's kind of fronts the poem here. So just because kind of what that meant, or when did you like sort of understand that you were going to be living with dogs, you know, out there. But I mean, and just, you know, the experience really, it is a narrative. It's got a beginning, a middle, and an end. And it does obviously rope back in at the very end to the title of the poem, which is really great. So I don't know. Yeah, just culturally just diving in and there was a hip-hop band called the Chicharrones, which are, I think, like pigskin, like, you know, fried pigskin,
yeah,
right? Yeah, those are pretty tasty.
Pork cracklins.
Pork cracklins, yeah.
I've always hated them.
They're not like, you can't have more than like three, maybe.
I don't know.
Do well, you even digest them?
Well,
like, what
I
happens
think so.
To
I know,
your body
I don't know,
when you,
you
eat
know,
them?
Not
are they
good
food?
Things,
Is
I'm
that
sure.
food? Sorry, we digress.
But it's a wonderful word. I love it in the poem just because it just rolls off. I mean, especially the way you pronounced it, as it should be pronounced, just in a way, just we ate chicharrones for fuck's sake. You know, it just has a nice like cadence to it. Speaking of cadence, I guess, I'll go back to that. So, yeah.
And the thing I'm curious, I think where the angst is felt is the comparison to wolves and what we think about wolves, the myths around wolves, you know, the big bad wolf and the three little pigs. And he has, you know, the pig skins right here with the wolf, right? And so pushing that tension between the two, I want to know who's the wolf. Is the wolf, is the wolf a bad guy here, right? And that's the impression we want to believe because of the narrative we've been taught. And so that's what I love, like what I feel you're doing, but I can see how this could be so misconstrued so easily. So Tomas, man, what's going on and what kind of angst do you get back?
And what is
from
the
people?
Truth? You know, yeah, never ever tell capitalize the truth. I'm curious in your context here.
Yeah, capitalization on truth.
So I guess at its most basic level, it's about assimilation. It's about generational change. It's about the conflict between the generation that immigrated to a country and the generation that was born here. And, you know, I don't think any parent or someone who would become a parent would come to the U.S. and say, I want my children who were born here to become outcasts. But at the same time, they're also going to say, and oh, by the way, I don't want them to be outcasts, but I don't want them to lose a shred of our culture. And that's not possible. It's an impossible request that your children carry all of your cultural traditions and fit perfectly into the mainstream in this country. And so there's always a tension there. There's always a sense of loss. You're always in some way at odds with, or even if you're not at odds, there's this idea that in moving here and having children, you're going to lose them in some way.
And there's probably a sense of duplicity, like how you're living your life. Like, because I've had friends who at home, there's a different experience. They're like walk into another country, you know, with language and movement and gestures and everything. And then they go to school and they behave a completely different way, or they go to work.
Right, the code switch.
Code switching, yeah.
And I mean, it has become a narrative. I know that you've written about it as kind of, you know, sort of a cultural truth, really, that you're kind of walking the line. There's a term you've used in previous work, I think, where you've talked about it with some, where you're, well, you can, you know, sort of elucidate, like, what is that, you know, sort of like that line you're walking kind of called, you know, where you're sort of in that in-between space culturally.
Oh, the word Nepantla.
Yeah.
That's a Nahuatl word that means, I think technically it means a space between two, or did you mean the word pocho? Nepantla is a
we
is
do
a
not
space
know what
we're sort of in, like a limbo space between cultures.
I would say Nepantla because that technically I think in the original Nahuatl meaning is a space between two bodies of water or between two hard boundaries that you can't traverse. Yeah. But as it's become more known, and I think maybe goes back also to the original meaning, I don't know. I'm not a Nahuatl speaker. I've studied it. I went to Mexico to learn from a cacique, but you know I didn't get beyond basic sentences.
Right.
But anyways, Nepantla has come to mean or come to refer to people or emotional or intellectual states that are not in one norm or the other. They're in the middle. And there is sort of this tension-based negative connotation to it. It's stuck. It's stuck in the middle. It's rebounded between these two things that are incompatible. But I think in recent years, there's also been an effort to make sure that Nepantla is also an area of opportunity. And I first came across the word when I was doing research in Mexico City. I was researching Inquisition documents from the 16th century and, or sorry, 17th century. And this one guy who was on trial complained about being the Pantla, being the... I'm in the Pantla. And I was like, what the hell is that? I've never seen that word. So I looked it up in my Nahuatl dictionary. And when I read it, I understood exactly what he meant. He stuck in the middle. He was stuck between two cultures.
Right.
And so I totally got that. And then, lo and behold, you know, activists have been talking about the Pantla for a couple of decades, and I had never heard of it.
And I think you had done, like, actually, gone to an event here on campus. We're on the Boise State campus right now recording this. That kind of incorporated some of that in the overall. I can't remember for sure, but I just remember you speaking about it when we were having one of our Zoom workshops back, you know, several months ago. But yeah, it's fascinating. And I wonder if you've ever talked to your folks or your family members about that kind of in-between sort of liminal space. And,
My mom. And I dramatized that in the novel, the delivery.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's not a happy scene, and it wasn't a happy scene in real life either.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, and that's where the conflict comes from. You know, your parents, or in my case, my mother, raises me as best she can to be as successful a person as I can be. And to do that, she has to push me away.
Right.
She can't let me be as Mexican as she was. And then blames you for not being as Mexican as she was.
Right.
So how was that supposed to work? And that was basically about the
I think that's every mother in every culture. I just want to say, like, my poor sons are dealing with some, like, but you're not doing this tradition, you know? And they're like, Mom, don't do that today.
I know. I suppose. Yeah, it takes many forms for sure. But yeah, especially this, I mean, coming in, immigrating to the different, any country, but this country in particular.
The assimilation is huge.
Yeah, absolutely.
And my mom herself was a part of that, because she was actually born and raised in the U.S., but her first language for many years was Spanish. So she was raised knowing where her family came from, but she felt stuck here. And then that element of stuckness is generational.
Yeah, so you are, you know, you're unthreading ancestral wounds, right?
Yeah.
Talking about them and opening them up.
There's an inevitability to the assimilation, but there's also a sense of loss.
Yeah.
Okay.
Cool.
Yeah, wow, so great.
I love it. Yeah, and it's definitely strong, and, you know, there's trouble afoot, which is, you know, rumbling beneath in the angsty sort of liminal space there we're talking about here today a little bit.
So speaking of angst, we've got three angsty poets.
Three.
Three of us.
So two of us have gone so far. So Christian, what do you got?
Well, what I have is I did have a friend of mine. I read it to them, and they asked, like, what is that about? It's a bit of a language poem that is fairly dense and has a lot of allusions in it, but it does come from a larger sort of group of poems I've been writing that I'm working title, The Building Behind the Church, Behind the Leather Bar, Behind the Cop Shop, Behind the Dollar Tree is on Fire. Long title, but it's about,
like either one word titles or really long titles. For me, there's nothing in between.
Right. Yeah. And then the working title of this particular poem, or maybe a small chunk of these poems, is called American Architecture. But yeah, I mean, there's, I can get into some of the allusions and sort of the sense of it, but I've been traveling around the Western United States mostly the last several years a lot, and have been sort of engaging with our pop culture and our political culture and just our gorgeous spaces and our really beat up shitty spaces too. So anyway, this is called American Architecture. So here, the old men are still old, have always been bully old, have always been gray as concrete. Here among the cul-de-sacs and the charging stations and the yellow line long haulers gone bankrupt and afraid. Here among the backhoes and happy endings of the border war bus boys eyeing the fruit dried yarns all noose tied and blameless in the suburbs of the suburbs, where the old men remain all bow leg and whist, smelling of lye and ewe meat. And the square footage wars of the border states a la 1974. And hey, the bones of America and its flightless birds are still hollow. And that cackle and sneer you're listening to is still laced with didact and wet paint, trying so hard to dry. And what might our mothers think of us out here upselling the tumult and washing behind all your ears but not our own, annotating the marginalia and finger-fucking the dukes and the duchess and the tincture wellness girl boys on the nightly news and on the daily, in the Hilltown Dollar Trees and the high desert outlet malls, the basins and the draws, the box canyons and the hollers, only asking later for forgiveness and never permission or consent, out here beneath the collision of atoms and insult rhymes. And like the old men dying so slowly, we also have some spare time to write all these wartime heyday stories down, each sad white morning alone with our sugarcane teeth and our straw pole best lives, on trial each and every with our mothers biting their nails to the tallow and our fathers in the counting houses tying off and genuflecting and bundling the pink petals and wet black boughs for some future bondage play out here beneath the cellar doors and the garbage islands and the big rock candy mountain.
Ooh. Yeah.
All right.
Sing it.
Let's go. I know.
I feel like if Bukowski were a beat poet.
And he's kind of sometimes considered a beat poet.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like he came later and just decided to not be a beat poet.
Right.
And how hard do you have to try to not be something before you just admit that you are? But right. I feel like those two to me kind of come together. That's the tone that I get. And
I'll take
and
that.
I yeah. love I love so much about that poem, but one of the things that really stands out to me is, as a lover of words, I love the several lines. One of the lines is the one where you mention different geographical terms like holler or box canyon.
Mm-hmm.
I love that because that invokes to me a very sort of 50s travelogue vibe. If it's not an actual Western, yeah, exactly.
The box canyons and the haulers. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. It is a cliche to say that takes me places, but when I hear words like that, I imagine myself in them. And while my brain has transported me to that place, I'm still getting the input of the words that keep coming. So that hits me several ways that I really enjoy. Did you read that before? Did you read that in the fall?
I did. I released a version of it. It was pretty similar. I read like a series of the three or four, because they kind of get a little hard to read in order. But yeah, blah, blah, blah. But you know, I also kind of did change a few things just structurally, so it looked better. But yeah, but not a lot. But
because there were parts in there where I feel like I have a vivid memory of looking at a tray of cookies.
this is an event we did in the fall in October, I think.
I heard several of these lines, and I turned around and said, wait a minute, screw the cookies. What's happening up there? Because I really like what I'm hearing.
He set the cookies aside for your poem, Christian.
That's saying a lot for me.
That is probably the ultimate compliment to a poet right there. Forget the comparison.
The big rock candy poet, mountain,
You know, for me... there's the nostalgia that you're talking about, but it's also timeless, mm-hmm. right? And so even though I feel like I'm being pushed back into a time capsule, it's also so applicable still today, like every single line. And that I felt like the energy in it definitely felt angsty, right? It felt like the speaker was really, you know, just trying to get some words out, trying to get some emotion out, trying to make sense and ownership and holding others accountable and pointing fingers, but also pointing a finger back to themselves. So it was really, so it crossed so many barriers and boundaries, right? You know, as far as time and also the accusation, you know, this is not an accusational poem. Because it's pointing a finger back, right? Mm-hmm. So it's calling things out and calling things out and calling things out. Back then, now, tomorrow, unfortunately.
Yeah, no, it's sort of, I guess, the way I sort of operate in this particular time of my poetry writing, you know, sort of is to let it all kind of hang out on the, you know, kind of working around this notion of that initial title, The Building Behind the Church, Behind the Leather Bar, Behind the Cop Shop, Behind the Dollar Tree is on Fire, which is our country and all the country I was traveling around, you know, and our political system and our social system and our social media kind of I don't know, onslaught. But then also then being driving
our
around.
Our relationships, like, our education system, our food chain, like it's everything, right?
Yeah, so it was spilling out. Then I sort of have to kind of figure out a way to hopefully make it look okay on the page and be readable and somewhat understood, you know, sort of. But yeah, thank you. But because, well, I don't know exactly where it came from, but I do know, I mean, at least in my mind, I don't precisely know how I landed on it, but like the Big Rock Candy Mountain, I don't know if you're familiar with that song. It's Harry McClintock, and it was in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou. It's an old-timey hobo song, too, you know, sort of. It's like a, and also one of my favorite writers, Wallace Stegner, had a book of essays, kind of, I think it was posthumously released, but it's called Where the Bluebird Sings to the Lemonade Springs, which is a lyric from, and like that was read it years ago. But anyway, so I landed back there, and that kind of fits the hollers and the draws and the box canyons, you know, because it's like the old, like the West, you know, be under attack in so many ways now, as our country is, but also just like the Big Rock Candy Mountain was never a thing. Like the America was never a thing that was like the Ronald Reagan, the shining city on the hill. Fuck that shit. You know, it's like, come, that's what you think you are, manifest destiny people. That's what, you know, it kind of was like manifesting in my own work. And then I just kind of let it all hang out and see what happens. But then also I do enjoy including like the Dollar Trees and the cul-de-sacs and just the, you know, the long haulers and just the feel of just the border wall politics / and the people living there, and then the invocation of like who's coming across, you know, sort of that border being in jeopardy in this shining city on a hill, you know. So
one thing that really strikes me though is the hard contrast or the juxtaposition between beautiful and profane. I mean, in the title and in the first line, those things can all happen. They're not happening or existing in their own silo.
No.
Yeah.
You can be staring at a beautiful mountain and then turn your head and you're staring at a burning trash pile.
Turn your head 1 degree.
It's a lot of that.
If you've traveled around this country enough, you know, the beauty exists right next to the gross. And that's because of us. That's because of what we've done.
Yeah.
I know.
Yeah, there's true two truths or more existing at once, not just right next to each other, sometimes on top of each other, right? Blended together. Like sometimes you can't dissect them. You don't even have to turn your head.
Right.
Yeah. You know?
Yeah, you can look over the burning trash pile at the
mountain. I know.
Right, exactly.
And there's the Big Rock Candy Mountain. Yeah. Or, you know, one of my favorite places to write about is like around the Salton Sea and how wrecked that place is. But also there's a mountain range right there called the Chocolate Mountains. You know, I don't think the indigenous folks name it that, but maybe it was from something that they had called it, but they are kind of chocolate colored and whatnot. But it's like so ironic, of course, like in this beautiful, broken, really stinky place, you know, literally. But we are kind of getting low on time because we have a half an hour, but we have, you know, we have two more episodes, right? Around
eggs. I know.
This is going to be fun.
This is going to be so fun. So very quick, one line of writing advice from each of you. Christian, go. You go first.
Oh, I just say write every day as much as you possibly can and not really with much inner editor going. Just let it fly and then work it out as you go forward.
All right. Tomas.
Don't censor yourself in your first draft. Just write. And if it doesn't suck, you're amazing. Mm-hmm. And if it does suck, then that's how it just works. So just write it down and then go back and go, oh, okay, that wasn't great, but I'm still a good person and I can get this right.
Okay, those are great. I don't know if I can top that. Here's mine is just write as if no one will ever read what you're writing.
I can't okay.
Just
that.
Write it with abandonment, man. Abandonment. Like you're going to burn the pages. Just write like that. And then you'll find out something new about yourself every time.
I know. That's hard to do because our inner editor is there and we say these things, but it is difficult. But also just, you know, I like to wake up super early and if I can and get it done before I'm really thinking about that inner editor as much. So, but yeah, anyway, we'll continue this conversation in a, you know, well, just in your headphones, just it'll be a matter of moments. But, you know, right now we're going to go out into the quad where some protesters might be showing up any minute here too. So there we go.
That's right. And if you haven't seen Civil War to like increase your angst, go watch that movie.
I haven't seen it.
I've heard about it and read about it.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah. Anyway.
Good movie. All right. So we're three angsty poets. Myself, Rebecca Evans, Tomas Baeza, and Christian Wynn, and we have a lot more angst to share, so you're going to hear from us.
That we do.
Thank you for joining us today. We'll be back next Monday. Tune in.